thinking better and thinking together about life's most important issues. A place to finally meet in the middle, to think freely and reasonably about the big questions of life. This is Thinker Sensitive. Welcome to another episode of Thinker Sensitive. I am your host, Ryan Ragazine. According to a 2021 article from the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, quote, "The ancient Olympic Games, held every 4 years at Olympia in honor of the god Zeus, were celebrated for over a millennium and serve as the inspiration for the modern competition. Surviving inscriptions and literary sources list the names of about 800 ancient Olympic champions. The first recorded victor was Choroibos of Elis, who won the Stadion foot race in 776 BC. The author continues, quote, "According to myth, many Greek gods and heroes competed in the first games at Olympia. Zeus wrestled his father Cronos for the throne. Apollo outran Hermes and beat Ares at boxing. And Heracles, often credited with founding the Olympic Games, won victories in wrestling and pancration, a no-holds-barred combat sport. Greek athletes looked to their heroic predecessors for inspiration. Milo of Croton, a famed wrestler from antiquity, styled himself after Heracles, even wearing the hero's trademark lion skin to complement his 6 Olympic wreaths. The Athenian boxing champion Dioxippas was renowned for defeating a fully equipped Macedonian soldier while dressed as a victorious athlete, in the nude with his body oiled, crowned with a victory wreath, and armed as Heracles, carrying only a club. And the legendary boxer Diagoras of Rhodes was proclaimed the son of Hermes for his superhuman athletic achievements. The ancient games featured many competitions that still take place in the modern Olympics, such as foot races, jumping, discus throwing, javelin throwing, wrestling, the pentathlon, a combination of the previous 5 events, and boxing. As today, athletes specialized in certain events and worked intensively with professional trainers. The ancient Greeks competed in a brutal, full-contact combat sport similar to mixed martial arts called the pancration, a combination of wrestling, boxing, and kicking, but with virtually no rules. Only biting and eye gouging were prohibited. Some fighters boasted nicknames reflecting their signature combat technique. Sostratos, a fighter from the city of Sicyon, was known as Fingertips because he would break his opponent's fingers at the start of a match. It's no wonder the Greeks became experts in sports medicine. End quote. The legendary classical Greek philosopher Aristotle most likely had the Olympic Games in the back of his mind when he wrote his famous Nicomachean Ethics. For Aristotle, similar to how Olympic athletes had to train for the Greek Games by committing to a strict diet, disciplining their bodies, enduring strenuous workouts, and building strength, speed, and stamina, everyday human beings, common people, have to train to be ethical or moral or good. They have to work to build character. They have to be made fit for a virtuous life that will result in a joyful and triumphant existence. On today's podcast, I will unpack Aristotle's so-called character or virtue ethic, highlighting both the strengths and weaknesses of his ethical approach, and demonstrating how Christianity represents the ultimate fulfillment of such an ethic. Like many philosophers both before him and after him, Aristotle believed that happiness was the goal of human life, the end of all human action. Aristotle surmised that human beings have a central or even singular function, one that corresponds to the very nature and essence of humanity. In previous episodes, I've defined human beings in triadic terms as those who are rational, free, and moral. Generally speaking, Aristotle would basically agree with this assessment. For Aristotle, humans are rational creatures and moral agents, agents whose free and deliberate decisions profoundly influence both who they are and who they are becoming. As free beings, our choices shape and form our ethical identities and moral destinies. If we routinely choose the good, we will naturally become good over time. And if we become good, we will naturally become happy. Again, for Aristotle, the function of a human being is to freely and rationally choose that which is good so that one might become good, so that one might become happy, experiencing the joy, satisfaction, and fulfillment that is only experienced in the good life and by those who have been trained in it. According to Aristotle, when a person functions optimally in all three of these areas or dimensions, rationality, freedom, and morality, a person will be virtuous. And if a person is virtuous, a person will be spared from the common human vices that so often breed unhappiness and dissatisfaction. Aristotle believed that the ethical life was the good life, that the moral life was the blessed life, that the virtuous life was the joyful life. He envisaged virtue, fostered and formed through the rational and moral activity of a free and deliberate soul in time, as the means to the end of happiness. For Aristotle, virtue, or moral and ethical formation, or the progressive cultivation of character, was the ultimate path to joy. According to Aristotle, happiness is not so much based on chance as it is on choice. This provides some reason for optimism. For though not all people are privileged and fortunate, all people are able to achieve happiness. The underprivileged and misfortunate person, despite his humble and lowly surroundings and circumstances, can be virtuous, and if virtuous, can be happy. Aristotle believed that the virtuous person could persevere in happiness through much misfortune. Jesus obviously believed something very similar, but he went even further, suggesting that the poor are ultimately more blessed than the rich in the long run. For in the kingdom, the first will be last, and the last will be first. The Latin American community in particular has often understood Jesus as the liberator of the poor and the savior of the impoverished. Latin Americans and Hispanics actually serve as a great example of Aristotle's view. I was talking to my wife about this last night. One could make the argument that out of all the ethnicities and people groups in our society, Hispanics work the hardest and are paid the least. Yet they are some of the happiest, most enthusiastic, and most satisfied people on the planet. They are always partying, always enjoying life, always celebrating, even in the face of misfortune. This is largely due to their character. In their lives, they have cultivated the virtues of gratitude and thankfulness. They have put off the kind of lust and envy and bitterness and resentment and complexity and duplicity and ungratefulness that often plague the rich, robbing them of joy and making them miserable. Many Hispanics have learned, have trained themselves to be satisfied with less, whereas many of those who are privileged have trained themselves to be dissatisfied with much. Those of Latin American or Hispanic heritage prove that it is not privilege or fortune, but virtue that makes a person happy in the end. As stated earlier, for Aristotle, virtue is cultivated and character is formed through moral or ethical training. Acts equal essence. If one acts morally, one will become moral. If one lives virtuously, one will become virtuous. Aristotle believed that people successfully build character through habitual action. By continually performing moral acts, through ethical repetition, one begins to cultivate virtue and build character. Thus, for Aristotle, virtue is an act of the will, something that is derived from much exertion and great effort. Happiness is something that is earned or merited. One has to work for it. One has to achieve and obtain it. According to Aristotle, virtue has a dispositional character. As we build virtue in our lives, we build moral and ethical tendencies, proclivities, and orientations. Virtue is also tied to human emotions. Possessing virtue, then, is not just a matter of having a disposition to act in a certain way, but it is also a matter of having a disposition to feel a certain way. Humans are able to manage and moderate their dispositions, feelings, and emotions through rational and moral activity and training. The hope is that our emotions will ultimately be subservient to and guided by the power and prudence of reason, which, in the history of philosophy, is a very traditional perspective. Aristotle has many different character traits in mind when he speaks about virtue, some of which are common and some of which are uncommon. The same goes with vice. One of the most insightful aspects of Aristotle's ethics is the idea that morality, virtue, and happiness are solely based on acting, doing, living, and being. It is not enough to talk about morality or to think about morality. One must enact justice and embody the good. For Aristotle, talking about virtue doesn't make you good. being virtuous makes you good. Furthermore, goodness or virtuousness is not predicated upon having right opinions or noble ideas or accurate thoughts. Even if those ideas, opinions, or thoughts directly pertain to ethics and the good life. Instead, goodness and virtuousness are based on ethical behavior and a moral lifestyle. Aristotle's moral philosophy is quite strong and quite commendable. Of course, it helps that I'm a personal proponent of a character or virtue ethic. I believe that Jesus of Nazareth was as well. Due to limited space and time, and for the sake of argument, my personal commendation of Aristotle's ethical system will focus on two primary strengths, both of which function as constructive criticisms of popular moral reasoning and contemporary ethical thinking. First, in an age of rampant virtue signaling, in a world where personal virtue and practical ethics are reduced to the mere signaling of morality through a variety of different mediums of communication, whether through pictures, icons, avatars, signs, tattoos, bumper stickers, posts on social media, or otherwise, Aristotle teaches us that real morality, that authentic goodness, that true virtue is not a matter of communication, whether in written or verbal form, but a matter of behavior, lifestyle, embodiment, and being, a matter of a life well lived. All other forms of morality are simply superficial, particularly when they're divorced from real moral formation and genuine character development. Second, in a cultural landscape where personal morality is reduced to having the right political ideology, and ethics and virtue are politicized and weaponized by liberals and conservatives alike, Aristotle teaches us that mere opinion or belief, that simply being on the right side of an argument, or simply possessing the right viewpoint, does not make a person good. Instead, it is right living and right action that make a person good. Believing the right things about abortion, for instance, doesn't make you good. Being good and doing good to those who believe differently than you make you good. I can also wage a specific criticism against the church on this point. In the history of the church, it has often been assumed that as long as you believe in the right things, then you're good. So, you can kill those who believe differently than you and still be a good and moral person as long as you have an orthodox Christology, for example. But God cares just as much about right practice as he does about right belief. In fact, I would argue that he cares more about right living than he does about right doctrine. God can tolerate distorted beliefs and imperfect theology. What he cares about most is the way that we live our lives. This is one of the main points that James makes in his lone epistle, and this is the point that the Apostle Paul makes in the beginning of his epistle to the Romans. Paul doesn't expect everyone to believe in the Trinity, for he knows that not everyone has the privilege of possessing the special revelation that he has, but based on the general revelation of conscience and moral law, he does expect everyone to live moral lives, which is something that he believes his own privileged community has often failed to do. Aristotle's ethical system has some weaknesses as well, which highlight some of the unique advantages of the Christian moral understanding. First, Aristotle lacks a realistic understanding of human nature. He doesn't seem to possess a proper awareness of the power and potency of inner corruption. Aristotle would have been edified by reading the Apostle Paul's words in Romans 7, for example. In certain places, Aristotle admits that it's difficult to be virtuous. But I don't think he realizes just how difficult it is. Second, Aristotle has a pretty limited understanding of the great virtues. For instance, as far as I've read, and thus as far as I'm aware, patience, mercy, faithfulness, humility, generosity, gratitude, selflessness, and love are all notably missing from his list of virtues. With that said, it's important to note that some of these may be implied by or tied to other virtues that he does mention. Aristotle would have also been edified by reading Paul's ethical discourse at the end of Romans. Third, Aristotle's moral philosophy would be greatly bolstered by a Christian understanding of grace, both sanctifying grace, which can be described as inner restoration or empowerment, and justifying grace, which can be described as mercy or pardon. Both inner healing and forgiveness are necessary solutions to the human problem of vice and the human condition of corruption. Finally, in Aristotle's ethical system, we lack a concrete ethical model or a historical moral exemplar to mimic and follow. One could argue, maybe rather ironically, that Aristotle's program represents ethical thinking without ethical embodiment. We have virtue and morality, but we're missing a Messiah and a Lord. No abstract moral system, no matter how deft and profound, can replace a living and breathing Christ. Jesus is the ultimate moral exemplar, the greatest example of character and virtue to ever walk this earth.